in America, there are two different tax codes. There's one for the wealthy elite and one for everybody else. And so I just became passionate about studying this stuff and learning, if I want to help more kids in foster care, how am I going to keep my tax dollars and grow that wealth so that I can give back more in a more meaningful way?
We're on a mission. We're going to find and uncover the smartest, most successful entrepreneurs on the planet, explore their highs, their lows, and how they ultimately mastered the game. I'm Martin Cook, and I'm excited to welcome you to the Smarter Destiny podcast. I'm grateful for you and your time. Now let's level up together. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another Smart Destiny podcast. So this time we're joined by my friend Sean Briscombe. Sean is an author, a co-trustee, a husband, and a dad. He's the founder of Strategic Wealth Network. Those are all awesome titles. He also has impacted over 100 children's lives by providing foster services, which has been funded by the things that he's put out there and built and sold in business. Does this kind of sound familiar? Does this kind of sound like a little bit of enlightened entrepreneurship? Maybe, maybe, maybe. Sean is a fantastic and fascinating and very successful entrepreneur. I'm very excited to have him on the show. And now I'm going to tell you why you should be excited for him to be on the show. Sean is the founder, if you like, of a tax saving strategy, maybe, or just he's a whistleblower for a tax strategy that the ultra elite use to save a ton of money on their taxes, which most of the world doesn't seem to know about and isn't leveraging. So, as a massive takeaway from this show, you are going to learn how to save a bajillion dollars off your tax bill if you listen to this show. That is incredible. I'm excited. We've spoken a little bit off air about like where this comes from, why it exists, why people don't know about it. And it was crazy. And I had to cut Sean short so that we could actually capture it for you guys on the show. So do not change your channel. Do not turn over. This is going to be one hell of a podcast. So without further ado, let's welcome Sean to the stage. Sean, how's it going?
Good, man. Thank you for having me.
I stumbled through that. There was a lot of different paths we could go with that introduction, you see, because there's actually a lot that you've done. And yeah, I'm excited to explore with you, but I think we're going to bounce about. It's going to be a tangenty episode, if that's all right with you, Sean.
Sure, absolutely.
So whereabouts in the world are you right now?
I reside in Austin, Texas, and I love it here. You know, we consider Texas the last of the free states.
I love it. And if you're watching on video, folks, Sean has a fantastic kind of Saudi Arabia Nights kind of feel going on with his backdrop and space that he's recording. He looks opulent and elegant. It's well worth watching. But what we like to do on this show, Sean, is we like to take things back. We like to go back to a time where you were kind of learning that you were an entrepreneur. You were kind of figuring things out. And perhaps there was some kind of life event, something emotional, something happened, which out of the back of that event, you started being a little bit more entrepreneurial. If you've got a time in mind, could you take us back to that and paint us a word picture?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I've had a very blessed life, a very kind of crazy life. I was a diver trained for the Olympic team here in America. And so from the time I was 8 years old, I was competing and training nationally and internationally. And when I was 14 years old, I moved away from home to train with Greg Louganis and the whole Olympic team down in Mission Viejo, California. We traveled the world and competed, and it was an awesome experience. And after the Atlanta Olympics, I kind of retired, and I was trained and with the Olympic coach at the University of Texas at the time, and I just made Austin my home. But my field of study was in physical therapy. I was a physical therapist by trade. And my desire was to become an entrepreneur and own a bunch of clinics. And at the time, there was a massive consolidation of healthcare clinics. And so these behemoths like Health South and some of these others were just, it was almost like the 800-pound gorilla. And it felt like it was a losing battle. So that coupled with the fact that I was still training full time and working full time, and the two schedules just were conflicting more and more and more, I ended up leaving physical therapy and going to work for the Home Depot, which is just a retail, you know, home supplies store here in America. They're worldwide, obviously, but they had a management training program for Olympic athletes that was unique. They would pay you a full-time salary with benefits, and you could travel and compete and train as much as you needed to, but they taught you management skills and how to run a business. And that was my first exposure to really managing and running anything. I had 50 employees, 250 employees, about 50 million in inventory. And, you know, we were a huge store in this area. From there, I was recruited out of that corporate setting to Dell Computers here in Austin. And at the time, it was the heyday at Dell, and everybody was working for Dell and making money through Dell stock at the time, where every year the stock was splitting and doubling and splitting again and doubling again. And they were throwing stock options at us like crazy. And so at the ripe old age of 29, I sold all of my options and sold everything that I had purchased from Dell stock. And I retired, thought that I had made it, right? Had over $1 million of cash and just kept it all in cash and played, went water skiing, traveled, hung out with friends. And by the end of that summer, I was approached by a friend of mine who was starting a .com here in Austin, Texas, which in the year 2000, the .com boom here was just incredible. There was money flowing from venture capital groups and individual investors like crazy. And so we started the very first online shopping mall called mall.com. And it was essentially what Amazon is today. But this is back in 1999, okay? And it was creative. It was unique. We ended up selling that company to Austin Venture Group here in Austin, Texas, for a huge pile of cash. And so there were five of us, five entrepreneurs, five guys sitting around a table with a bunch of money. And, you know, just like the young bucks that we were, the decision was made to push our chips into the center, double down and go all in on the next project. And that was right during the .com bust. And so we ended up in the second project was even a bigger company. It was this demand driven software that was, we had struck a deal with Sun Microsystems with Scott McNeely, and he was going to put this software in every single server. It was going to be this huge deal. And then all of a sudden the market switched, everything stopped. He pulled the plug. You know, we called up our investors, we called up, you know, VC firms in town, and not only were they not giving anybody any more money, but they were like, hell no. If you're a software company or a .com, no more, right? It was over. And so we had to shut our doors, lay off a bunch of employees and kind of lick our wounds. And I had to hit the reboot button and start all over again, figure out what was next. And so some friends of mine were involved in real estate lending and investing at the time. And I thought it was interesting. It was the next asset class that seemed to be going up. And so I started riding that trend and learning from as many people as I could about, you know, how do you manage real estate when there's, you know, there's a lien against this asset. How do you manage both sides of that balance sheet, the asset side, as well as the debt side, you know? And we got really good at it. We created a system where we were harvesting equity out of the properties and then investing it in other things safely. And it was growing. And we had done that successfully with a bunch of clients and made a bunch of money. And it seemed like it was going to go on forever until 2006. I got a phone call from a friend of mine named Kyle Bass. Now, Kyle is a hedge fund manager out of Dallas, Texas. He was a diver in college with me, and we got to be good friends through diving, and we just kept in touch throughout the years. But Kyle had seen, he was the youngest hedge fund manager in Bear Stearns history. He went to Legg Mason, managed his own portfolio of real estate debt, and then created his own hedge fund by himself. He raised $107 million, and he bet against mortgage-backed securities. It was him and a couple of other hedge funders that saw that mortgage-backed securities were about to blow up, that prices of homes were skyrocketing, but jobs and incomes were flattening out. And it was the first time in 30 years where that was a break, where they were decoupling. And he saw that, and he started investigating it. And he started asking really, really tough questions. And his conclusion was that this wasn't going to end well for anybody. So he raised a bunch of money and he invested in an insurance product called CDSs, credit default swaps, which meant if the mortgage-backed security didn't pay and it blew up, the insurance product would pay off. And it was just a hedge, right? But he bought a bunch of it very cheaply and he just waited. And the whole time we were having conversations and he was saying, you got to get out of the market. You got to get out of the market. Go to cash. Sell everything, go to cash. And I just didn't see it. I didn't believe him. I looked at all of his data and I literally thought, you know, buddy, God, I hope you're wrong. That was my reaction, you know? And sure enough, in what was it, September of 2009, Lehman Brothers collapsed and he owned all of the credit default swaps against Lehman Brothers subprime mortgages.
There was a movie on this, was there not?
Yes. Yeah. It was a movie called The Big Short.
That's right. Yeah. Was and that about him?
He's one of the characters in the movie. You know, he's amazing. Not the main hedge funder that you follow around, but he's one of them that's discussing everything. So a lesson learned, you know, I lost everything again, had to hit the reboot button all over again. So this is the second time that I had made a bunch of money and lost it. And then I made a bunch of money and lost it again. And it, going into 2009 and 2010, I was just completely bruised, battered, and broken. We were about to lose our house to foreclosure. My business was failing. I was completely unplugging and isolating and sedating and not working and, you know, falling into this just complete pit of despair and feeling sorry for myself. And, you know, so my wife at the time, we had just gotten married at the time and we got pregnant with our first child. And during this whole time when the business was failing and the market was changing, we ended up losing our daughter, Charlie, she was stillborn. And so that crushed me even more. My wife ended up meeting a friend at a church. She pulled into a church parking lot randomly and got a knock on her window, and it was her best friend from high school who she hadn't seen in years, just randomly showed up. And she said, hey, why don't you join us? We got a bunch of people over in another town. We're starting another church. You know, it's kind of a cool group. And so she started going every Sunday to church with her friend. And she asked me if I would go. And I was like, no, I'm done. Thanks, but no thanks, right? It doesn't work. That was my mindset. And so she just kept going. And then it was coming up on November Thanksgiving time. And the church was doing a food drive where they were getting a bunch of Thanksgiving items. And then the last week they collected a bunch of frozen turkeys and they were going to deliver them to people that didn't have anything for Thanksgiving. That was the plan. And so they needed a truck. And I had a truck that had 214,000 miles on it. It was leaking oil. And my wife came to me and she said, hey, we need to borrow your truck for this thing. And I said, well, I'll drive because I don't want it to break down. But here's the deal. I'm not getting out of the car. That was the deal, right? So I drive them out to this new area. And it's at a local middle school where they're getting everything together, a meeting. And I pull into the parking lot and all I see everywhere were children. I'm sure there were adults there too. There had to have been, but all I saw were kids carrying bags of groceries, grinning ear to ear, and just so excited to help other kids that didn't have anything. And I lost it. I started crying. I looked up and I was like, okay, I get it. And I didn't have any money at the time, didn't have any direction, didn't know what I was going to do, but I just started showing up and volunteering and helping out. And instantly, everything started changing. I was connected to an entrepreneur in Austin, a marketing kid that was had saved $34 million from his marketing efforts and had also escaped the subprime mortgage meltdown. And at the time, he was creating a new online educational platform, financial services platform for people, showing them the black box secrets of the rich. And I just happened to know this little tiny secret strategy that a lot of wealthy families use. Over 200,000 families are in the system. And so I presented him with it, and we ended up cutting a video. It was a boring dry video with two guys sitting on, you know, bar stools with a whiteboard behind us mapping out this strategy, but it took off. We had, 50,000 members at the zenith, at the peak of the project, and all of them paying about $800 a year in fees. And it just exploded. It became very successful. And so this time around, I was like, you know, I've cycled twice. I've made a bunch of money and I've lost it all. And I've made it again and lost it all. And I was like, I have to get serious about keeping my money and growing my money. And so simultaneously at the time, some friends of ours at church were getting their foster care license. And my wife and I were still in pain from the loss of our daughter. And they approached us and they said, hey, why don't you get your license with us? You know, they had kids of their own, but they wanted to help more kids that were suffering in Central Texas and in the foster care system. And we were really reluctant for obvious reasons, right? But we decided to take the leap of faith. We got our license. And the first two girls that we got, Chiquita and Sarah, were 2 and 4 years old. They were from a sibling group of six kids living in a one-bedroom apartment. Parents were cooking meth. And when the police came, they took all the kids to a group home for foster care. And there weren't enough beds for the two youngest ones. And so we got the phone call. And that was our very first experience loving on these kiddos, right? And helping these kids that are dealing with trauma and abuse and neglect. And it changed everything. I immediately was like, this is what we have to do. This is what we're going to do for the rest of our lives. But now I had a bigger problem. My business was making money. I was back on top again, but I was losing hundreds of thousands of dollars to taxes and interest expense and inflation and fees and all of this other stuff that we all deal with as entrepreneurs, right? And every tax expert, attorney, estate planning attorney, everybody I talked to had the same old advice that was in the 1040 tax world. You know, in America, most people file a 1040 tax return. And 1040 just means that you're taking on income yourself, or you have a business that's taking on income and you're the manager, right, of the LLC. And so you're still taxed on everything, right? You're taxed on what you make, you're taxed on what you own, you're taxed on what you buy, what you sell, everything. If you're in the 1040 world, that's how it works. But what I discovered was that in America, there are tax systems. There's a judge who passed away back in 1961 named Billings Learned Hand. And Judge Hand was on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And he's famous for a lot of different quotes. He specialized in tax law and tax matters. He's one of the most quoted judges in Supreme Court history. And he said in 1957, in a court case, he said, in America, there are two different tax systems, one for the informed and one for the uninformed, and both are legal. And so I had this mind-blowing experience where all of a sudden I was talking to my hedge fund buddies and they were saying, look, this is what we're doing. We're using, you know, we don't own anything technically. We've given it up to trusts and to our foundations, but we control everything. And because we don't own anything, we're not taxed on it anymore. And so that was my first realization, was that in America, there are two different tax codes. There's one for the wealthy elite and one for everybody else. And so I just became passionate about studying this stuff and learning, if I want to help more kids in foster care, how am I going to keep my tax dollars and grow that wealth so that I can give back more in a more meaningful way? That was the goal at the time. And I just went on a journey of discovery and started talking to everybody I could, from my hedge fund manager friends and all of their attorneys. And I discovered this system that's called the 1041 system, because it files a 1041 tax return instead of a 1040 tax return. All right. When you file a 1041 tax return, the rules of the game change. In 2014, Nelson Rockefeller was at his family's foundation meeting, and he said, "The secret to success is to own nothing, but to control everything. To own nothing, but to control everything." You see, because taxes follow title or ownership, the wealthy elite understand if you give up ownership without losing control, without giving up control, but if you give up ownership, now you're not taxed and the rules of the game change.
So this, okay? this makes absolute sense. The even to me, right? And I'm in the UK. We don't have 1040 or 1041. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we've got equivalents. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, tax planning services. And at this point, I want to sort of make it, as I put in the introduction, like completely applicable to everyone around the world, sure. The majority of people around the world, to understand this thing. This isn't a US only thing that is available that we're talking about right now, where if you're outside of the US, it doesn't apply to you. We're talking about a principle which we can interchange 1040, 1041 for whatever the relevant names in the relevant location are.
And there the principle are Russian is still oligarchs today who are laughing at the sanctions and are publicly coming out saying the sanctions don't affect me because I don't own anything. What does that mean? How are they able to do that? It's same structure that they're using. And the reason it's so effective and the reason that it works internationally is because it's based on international law. The articles of the trust indenture, the contract language itself lends itself to have an international jurisdiction, which is key. It's a small little change in the actual documentation itself. But it's one little secret that the wealthy elite understand that everyone doesn't, you know? And so there are multi-layers to this game that they play, but the basic concept is they give up ownership of everything, but they never lose control. And when you give up ownership, two things happen. You're not taxed on it, and liability goes away, personal liability goes away.
So let's get this into a sort of a real world example.
Sure.
So we have a business owner somewhere in the world, and mm-hmm. that business owner has a very profitable business.
Sure.
What sort of real world example might you give for how he can retain control and give away ownership? What vehicles or institutions might he create or sure. she to give up the ownership but keep the control?
So in America, we use LLCs or S-Corps typically to create our business structure, and that is registered with the state where you're going to be doing business. So when you get an LLC, you're operating by permission of the state, okay? I don't know what it is internationally, but it's something similar. Whatever the incorporated business entity is.
Yeah, it's a limited company in the UK.
Right. Mm-hmm. So in a limited company, you could be the manager of the company, but have maybe 2% ownership, right? So where does the liability fall on that company? To you personally or to the majority owner?
Limited liability, it stops with the company and the benefactors of
so
that company.
That concept, if you take that idea and you take it to the next level and you make it international, if I don't own anything and I've given up ownership of it and I've distributed that money to the trust from my business, from my company, now the company doesn't own it. The company and all assets as well. Maybe there's a building involved. Maybe there's, you know, assets owned by the business. I don't know, fleet vehicles, for example. If those are owned by the trust and somebody sues the business, what are they going to get?
Nothing.
Right? It gets better. Now, because of the trust structure, trusts are created for two reasons, not taxes. They're created for two primary reasons: protection of your assets and privacy. Protection and privacy. The tax savings becomes the cherry on top. When you start to live in this trust world and foundation world, and you start to operate as a trustee, everything changes. You know, you're if I make $1 million, $1 million hits the company. You know, if I take in $1 million personally, what am I taxed on that $1 million? If it's just my personal income, I'm taxed on $1 million, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the highest tax rate, 37% in America. So I would have to pay $370,000 in taxes. But if I create an LLC or a company and I don't own it and the money hits the company, now I'm not taxed on it personally. The tax rules of the game change. I can take deductions. I can have expenses taken out, right? Lower my tax liability. There's all kinds of things you can do. The trust world has the same kind of options. They're just at another level. You know, when you're talking about your corporate entity, it's typically at the state level. And so there's not a lot of sovereignty there. The federal government can always pierce that veil and take your assets, right? But when you're in the trust world, the jurisdiction is national or international, depending on the trust, right? Depending on what you're doing. But if it's international and you get sued, if you personally got sued, you wouldn't own anything. Does that make sense?
It does.
It's kind of a long-winded answer. I apologize, but...
So in the trust example, we understand the once removed, and I think it's fairly commonplace, right? Rather than earning money directly where you're getting taxed on that, have the company mm-hmm. earn the money, and then there's expenses which you might personally benefit from and so on, but all of that comes out. Rather than you being taxed at a company level and then buying the thing personally, being taxed again, buying it personally, mm-hmm. you know, you'd be like double taxed here on something that could have been bought higher up and avoiding taxes. So I think most people in the audience will get that sort of jump. Okay, so now in a scenario where all of the assets and profits from the company are going up to the trust level, how do you, Sean, get paid in that structure where there's the trust is getting everything, the LLC is getting just enough to sort of tick over but not really be profitable or whatever? And then you're underneath that.
Yeah, that's a good question, because most people get in trouble for using a trust like a piggy bank, right? And that's not the intention of a trust. A trust has a very specific purpose, as does a private foundation, right? A 501c3, a charity. The purpose is not for you. It's for others. And that's what makes it so magical, is when you start to operate for the benefit of other people, it's a different game entirely. So... but the question of what can the trust pay for and what can it not pay for, those rules of the game are very, very specific. All right. And so we have to play by the rules of the game. And so sometimes that means that we have to take a little bit of income on our 1040 tax return. And so you have to kind of calculate if the trust is going to pay for expenses of assets in the trust, or perhaps like the you have a trust that owns the family assets and you're the trustee and your kids are junior trustees or your kids are beneficiaries. The trust now can be responsible and pay for certain expenditure beneficiaries, right? And those include major expenses like housing, healthcare, education, insurance, things like that. So if the trust is going to pay for all those major expenses, what's left?
Not a lot.
Food, maybe, general, you know, lunches
and Netflix subscription,
entertainment. Yeah. You know, gas for your daily driver, your car, fashion, stuff like that, you know. But even in business, if you buy a suit for business, that could be a deduction to the company, right? Yeah. So there are certain things in the trust that can be expenditures to the trust that you're like, well, wait a second, that's clothing, or wait a second, that's something else. But if it's legitimate, then you can use it as an expenditure. But you do have to take a little bit of income to pay for the dentals that are not covered. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And, so it's not like you're getting to use it as your own private piggy bank, right?
And so when with your clients who you're teaching teaching this to, when they've got it set up, what kind of guidance do you offer, like, for the trust? Like mm-hmm. what kind of responsibility do you distill into them, sure. or encourage them to take?
Yeah. So it's been my experience that if you go to a big five firm, they will show you this exact structure. This is a very unique structure. It's not taught to business owners and entrepreneurs that are under $50 million. $50 million is usually the private client level. And that's when they finally introduce this concept to you. Okay. So if you have $50 million net worth or higher, you can go to Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, any of the big five firms, or international firms as well, right? And they can do this for you. But you've got to put all of your assets with them, including opening a money market account, earning nothing, with millions of dollars in it, right? Just to be able to have the privilege of getting this. Their attorneys, their tax team will take care of everything for you, and you won't learn a thing. That's been my experience. My clients come to me with that experience. Now, if you're not paying that much in taxes, if your tax team is able to pay your tax liability enough, then it might be cheaper to just stay with them, right? As a business owner. But there's nobody taking care of anybody in between in that gap, right? The 50 million in under up to that certain level. And so what we thought was, based on the feedback that I was getting from friends that were doing this as well, that had family offices like we have, they were saying, you know, I wish that we could learn this stuff. And so I just happened to have written the book on the subject. And so I decided, why don't we create a whole network of giving leaders, people that are business owners, entrepreneurs, and investors who are doing really big shit on the front end, but their focus is on doing more and giving back in a more meaningful way. Like, what if we could pull them all together and we could support each other in our endeavors, in those charities, in those missions, right? And so I just started doing that. I started teaching this to business owners, entrepreneurs, and investors. There's a large upfront fee that has to pay for the attorneys to structure the contracts, to file everything correctly with the government entities, to make sure that all the documentation is done correctly. But once that's set up, we meet all the time on a regular basis. We meet quarterly with the whole team, and we do what's called a general's tent meeting. We do a return and report, what happened last quarter, so we can document everything correctly. Where are you at today? And what do you want to do next quarter so we can plan it accordingly? We record everything. You get a copy. We keep a copy. We educate you every step of the way on how to be a better trustee. Because like John, my attorney, my general counsel, always tells me, he's like, you know, just because you have trust documents doesn't mean you have a trust. It's everything you do after that that matters. But nobody's teaching it, the entrepreneurs and investors and business owners, any of that stuff. So we just created it. We just built it. I said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to educate every single business owner, entrepreneur, and investor on how they can tax. And I'm not just talking about federal income tax. I'm talking about taxes at every level, city taxes, county taxes, state taxes, and federal taxes, income tax, property tax, capital gains tax, everything. What is that number for you? If you added up all those taxes that you pay throughout 1 year, what is that number for you? You know? And when you think about that number, we're not just talking about saving that money this year. We're talking about saving it next year, the year after that, the year after that, the year after that, forever into perpetuity, not just in your life, but your kids' lives, your grandkids' lives, for as long as you want to maintain this entity. Okay? That's the power of what we're doing. And so along the way, if you're able to plug those holes and stop the bleeding, number one, you're changing your family's bloodline forever. You know, we look at the Rockefellers and the Hiltons and the Kennedys today, and we think, wow, that's impossible. We'll never get there. But they all had to start somewhere, right? I'm the first generation of my family's legacy that's doing this. My daughters are currently being trained on how to operate as a trustee inside of a trust. Same with our foundation. We have a private family foundation called Kind Foundation. My daughters love to do lemonade stands in the neighborhood, right? But here's the difference. All the kids get together and they all do their lemonade stands at the same time. And they make these signs that say, all money is donated to Kind Foundation to help kids in foster care. Now, I've got two girls that we've adopted from foster care, and we're probably going to adopt a lot more on an ongoing basis. We've had 10 little girls come through our house, right? It gives these kids a chance to tell them their story. And the question I have for you is, how much money do you think these girls make in their lemonade stands?
I have no idea.
Preposterous, okay? When you lead with philanthropy and you have a higher mission and purpose, a higher calling, and you're actually doing it, you're putting in place the structure to actually pull that off, your conversations change with everybody, with your business partners, with your prospective investors, with other people. You know, I had a conversation yesterday with the head of community outreach for the National Football League. She's in Las Vegas right now during the draft, right? They're having the draft right now. And she was on a Zoom call with me for an hour and a half. And she was like, do you mind if I send you some players? I would never, ever have the opportunity to talk to these guys if it wasn't for what I was doing, right? When I start talking about our philanthropy and the power of what we're able to do for these kiddos, everybody wants to know how to do the same thing.
100%. And this is something we teach. A lot of our audience are e-commerce entrepreneurs. And it's something we teach that the responsibility of having something whereby some sort of metric where, you know, with every sale, you remove a certain amount of plastic from the ocean, or every sale, you plant trees, or you donate something, or, you know, you feed shelter dogs or whatever it is. But
venture,
you've got a metric.
Philanthropy. So I heard this term. It's not mine. I wish I come up with this because I think it's brilliant. Venture philanthropist. That's what you're describing.
Absolutely.
A venture philanthropist. Someone that is really focused on creating something meaningful and big and making a ton of money, right?
Exactly.
Because we have to have capital. We have to if we want to do good.
And those metrics are tied to the revenue. So you can set your goal in terms of the philanthropy metric. So in our case at Nubru, it's meals fortified for malnourished children. It's meals fortified is the metric. And it's tied to revenue because it's, you know, a chunk of every single sale goes to, we fortify meals for at least one child for at least a year with every single purchase, right? And so
you have these
metrics, and we encourage that. And now adding in the trust element to the business so that the trust is actually doing the venture philanthropy it makes it even stronger. It makes it even easier to do. More of that money will go to the cause. And so for the people listening today, where can they find out more about you? Where can they get hold of your stuff? How can they reach you? Where can they go?
Sure. Yeah. So I've written a book. It's called The Truth About Taxes, How the Wealthy Elite Play a Different Game. It's available in all bookstores worldwide. You can go to the website, thetruthabouttaxes.org. It's a .org because every dollar that I collect from the sale of the books, guess where it goes?
Does it go to a trust?
Kind Foundation to help kiddos. So I practice what I preach, you know, and that's the last thing. We talked about the first two, that number one, in America, there are two different tax systems. And number two was the secret to success is to own nothing but to control everything. Control versus ownership, right? The third key secret is that if you want to build massive generational wealth, you have to first learn how to give it all away. And so if you look at some of these private foundations, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for example, you know, the story of Bill and Melinda Gates and the creation of that foundation is really interesting. You know, Warren Buffett, his father, Howard Buffett, was in this Senate. He was in Congress. He was a congressman from Nebraska. Congress writes our tax laws, and then they write the code for themselves, the 1041 code that they get to follow. So Howard Buffett raised Warren Buffett in the 1041 trust and foundation system. He just had to operate in trusts, right? Well, in 2000, Microsoft and Bill Gates were under investigation by the IRS. They were bringing in foreign income and not claiming tax on it, okay? So the IRS, the FBI came in, raided everything, brought them to court, and it was just horrible, horrible situation. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett ended up meeting for the first time in 2000. Warren Buffett taught Bill Gates this system. 6 weeks later, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was set up, and Warren Buffett pledged $34 billion to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. What do you think they did with the $34 billion of donated money from Warren Buffett?
No idea.
They turned right back around and invested it in a little known company called Berkshire Hathaway. And now all of that stock is tax exempt. That's the game these wealthy elite are playing. They're giving away their money during their lifetimes. You may have heard about the Giving Pledge. Have you heard about that?
Nope.
The Giving Pledge was started by Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. And it was a simple idea. They were going to approach all the wealthy billionaires around the world and get them to commit to giving away their money during their lifetime. During their lifetime is the key. If you give it away once you die, there could be estate tax involved, right? And so they've been going around the world teaching wealthy billionaires this strategy, this system, and they've been pledging to give away their money to their private foundations during their lifetime for the good of all humanity or whatever the tagline is, right? What they're really doing is they're completely controlling that wealth in a tax-free system. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shame, because when this system was created in America, it was in 1913 when the IRS was first started in America with the Treasury. And these two systems were created. And the idea was that if the wealthiest families in America didn't want to pay tax, which they didn't want to pay this new tax, they said, well, okay, if you're not going to pay the tax, then you have to be responsible for charity and giving back. And so in order to not be paid tax, you have to give up ownership of your stuff and just put it in a trust for the benefit of society. And they said, okay, we'll do that. So it was started out with the most pure of intentions. But 100 years later today, this system's been completely bastardized by a lot of the billionaires around the world. You know, so my mission and purpose is to change that. I'm looking for elite business owners and entrepreneurs that want to band together and help each other out and change the world.
Amazing.
Who want to keep their tax dollars, grow that wealth, and in the process, give back a lot more in a lot more meaningful ways.
And the location that the people in the audience that fit that criteria, the people curious about what you're doing, the people that want to get involved, the people that meet the criteria that you just stated, is the book, The Truth About Taxes, which they can find in bookstores around the world, or thetruthabouttaxes.org, the website, and they can get in. Then I highly recommend you check it out, particularly the website. I think it's absolutely fascinating, this secret world that you're exposing for the benefit of the world. And so definitely check that out, folks. Sean, at this point in the show, we like to mix it up. We go into the rapid fire question round. I ask the questions quickly. You can choose the speed in which you respond. Are you up for that?
Yes, sir.
Are you two thumbs up for that?
Yes, sir.
Let's see those thumbs. There we go. Let's jump in. If you ever had to start again, how would you make your money?
I would be giving back more. I would be in charity. I would be in philanthropy.
Nice. What's the most common or biggest mistake leaders make?
Buying into their own bullshit, their own stories.
Who is a great leader, whether alive or dead, and why?
A servant leader. You know, I personally believe that Jesus Christ was the perfect model of a servant leader, and that's what I try to emulate. And the people in our network are all servant leaders. They're all giving leaders. Now, that doesn't mean they're all Christians, but they have that mindset. It's a mindset. They lead with service first.
Can you give an example, a real world example of leading with service, like a quick example of someone that's not necessarily a massive leader, but just someone who's like, you know, in the community?
True. Tim Kennedy, Special Forces, Master Sergeant, Green Beret, MMA fighter, ranked 5th in the world in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, just an absolute badass, right? Could crush any of us with his pinky. But he is the most giving, generous person I think I've met in a long time.
And what is the generosity and giving that he's doing?
He is helping to train people to preserve and protect human life. And he has created a school called Apogee School, Apogee Cedar Park, here in Cedar Park, a suburb of Austin, that is changing education. He's flipping education upside down. Tim was also responsible recently in the Afghan pullout of helping to save 19,000 lives in Afghanistan. He was one of the special forces operators that went in there undercover without government authority or permission. And they saved 19,000 people.
Amazing. And if you want to learn more about Tim Kennedy and the schools that you mentioned, you can listen to the interview with Matt Beaumont, Matt Boudreau, who we went into this, and it was an amazing episode. All right, back to the questions. What is one of your proudest moments?
Oh, man, this is a tough one. I used to believe it was something that I did in diving. You know, a medal that I'd won or an achievement that I'd made. And I don't think it's anything like that now. I think it's the work we're doing with these foster kiddos. You know, we're literally helping these kids to heal from trauma and abuse and neglect. And there's a lot of science behind it, but it's also an art. And I feel like our foundation has really pioneered in that space and leading the way in that space.
Beautiful. What daily routines do you have, whether morning or evening, that have helped make you successful?
I do what's called the Core Four. I learned it in a business group called Wake Up Warrior from Laguna Beach. I do four things every single morning. I wake up and I drink a green smoothie, get some nutrition in my body, and I work out. I train hard. I meditate and pray, and then I journal whatever insights are coming in. I connect with my wife and my kids every day. I write my daughter's little notes and I stick them in their lunches. The notes all are around love, honor, and respect, because I want to drive that into them and just, you know, deposit that as much as I can. And then the last thing I do is I learn something about business or marketing or systems or sales, and I try to apply it that day. And so it's just a routine that I picked up years ago that I'm still doing today. That, you know, I got to wake up early. I wake up early, like 5:30 in the morning, and I'm up and at it. It gives me space to create for myself. It's really good for my mind, you know, especially for men, businessmen and business entrepreneurs who are married with kids. You know, we need those breaks. We need those gaps.
That time before everyone wakes up and everyone needs you is magical. That is, you get so much done during that time. And then you're ready. You're ready for everybody to wake up and you're ready to
serve. 6:30 a.m. We had jiu-jitsu this morning and I was rolling on the mats and got crushed and, you know, got beat up, and it was awesome. Felt great.
What book or books changed your mindset or life?
That's a good one. The Bible, first and foremost, shifted everything for me. Most recently, I think I might have mentioned The Diamond Cutter. Highly recommend it. It's a mindset shift book. It's a book about a white man who went to Tibet and became a monk for 25 years and then left that, went to New York and grew the largest diamond company in New York, $200 million, gave it all away. Fascinating book on how we think about money, wealth, and what is ours.
Love it. The Diamond Cutter. I don't think we've had that recommendation on the show before, so I love it when that happens. What advice would you give your younger self?
Don't take things so seriously. You know,
don't take yourself so seriously.
This is crazy. When I grew up, 8 years old to 14 years old, I was one of the best divers in the country, if not the world. And, you know, just everywhere I went, they would roll out the red carpets. They would carry our bags. And so I grew up believing these bullshit lies about myself and my own importance. And I'll never forget it. After the Olympics was over, we had a big celebration. It was at the Home Depot where I was working, managing at the time. And our district manager came in and all the executives and, you know, Arthur Blank was there, the founder of Home Depot. And party was over. And my boss came up to me and he goes, okay. He's like, the loading docks in the back need to be swept out. It's really bad back there. Can you go take care of that? And I was like, okay. And I'm back there sweeping the loading docks at the Home Depot after just being on worldwide television. And I'm like, don't these people know who I am? And all of a sudden it hit me like a ton of bricks. I was like, holy crap, what am I doing? Who the hell do I think I am? Right? Like, I'm not special. There's nothing in my life that I can point to that is any better than anybody else that's listening to this podcast, you know? And so that for me, just, it shattered my mindset, my self-view. It made me rethink all of those stories in my head about myself.
So, I love that. I love
long-winded
that.
Yeah. Answer. I apologize.
No, I loved it. I added context and that was my follow-up question. So it's all good. We went off piece briefly. What unusual or underrated food or drink should more people try out?
Water. Water is the most underrated drink. You know, God, it's a life force. 70% of the planet is water, and yet we don't drink enough.
I agree. It's why I created a supplement company where you mix the powder with water. You are hydrating yourself in order to take your supplements. And also you get more of it in the same thing. Yeah, water. I think we've had that a couple of times on the show. I mean, we've done over 160 episodes.
Sure.
it's such a simple answer. And often the simple and obvious answer is the right one. And water.
Simple,
absolutely.
But not easy, right?
Yeah, exactly. And people complicate it by adding all kinds of stuff. Just get out. I think water tastes delicious when it's cold, filtered. It tastes amazing. Anyway, last question, and it's the most important one, Sean. Don't let me down. What makes you happiest?
What makes me happiest? The happiest I feel is when I'm giving. That's it. You know, when I'm pouring into other people, I recently went to Asheville, North Carolina to be with Matt Boudreau. He had an Apogee Strong event. And, you know, it was all the mentors were supposed to be there. It was the very first live event that he was hosting. And all these people had been on his podcast and were expected to be there. And nobody showed up except for me. And it made me feel like, you know, I got, obviously they kept coming up thanking me, which felt great. But just the fact that, you know, in that moment, I was the guy that showed up for all of those guys, for all those boys, you know, and these are 12 to 17 year old young men that are just trying to figure out life, trying to figure out what they're supposed to be doing, who they are, you know, a lot of them from really horrible backgrounds, you know, single mom families, things like that, that are just, you know, there's no male father figure in their life and they're trying to figure it out. So that makes me feel the best is when I'm giving back, when I'm serving other people.
Well, that's a fantastic answer. And it's also a little bit of a theme of this podcast. You have given back to so many people listening today. You have taught them at least, or at least shown them the door and the why behind the reason for going through the door as to how to set up your business differently so that you can, one, serve the world better, and two, reduce your tax burdens, all of them across the, all of the different things that we get taxed for across our space, and taking advantage of a loophole that previously was reserved to the for the ultra rich.
Yeah, Sean, it's you know, one of those things that if you can just imagine what your life could look like if you could plug those holes, like what kind of investments would you be making? If
the compounding effect of keeping those taxes and utilizing them for positive change. I believe big change will come from, or does come from, like entrepreneurs, not government and corporations anyway. So like keeping that money and pairing that up with a deep responsibility and understanding that it's your job as an enlightened entrepreneur to make the world better, to use your influence, to use your wealth, to use your network, whatever it is, to make the world better, indeed better than when you found it. Amazing. Everyone in the audience should look into this, explore this, take this on, set a goal to make some progress on here, to get some momentum, because this is a huge, huge learning, a huge opportunity that you can take as a result of Sean bringing it to us on the masses. So Sean, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. The truth about taxes is where to find out more about Sean. You know how to use Google. If you are listening to this podcast, you are smart. You know how to use Google. The truth about taxes is where to go. Sean, thank you so much for taking the time and spending it with us and educating us today on the show.
It was my pleasure, man. Thank you for having me. And if there's anything I can do to serve you in the future, let me know.
Hey there, you incredibly good-looking human. Thanks so much for listening. If you had a good time today and would like more good times in the future, please hit that subscribe button and leave a heartwarming review. I read them all and it will go a long way to help others out there benefit from all the teachings of this show. And if you want to get in touch or otherwise learn more about me, head to martincook.co.uk or smarterdestiny.com. I really appreciate you. You're an incredible human. Until next time, keep crushing.